silver and bronze, stood on a rocky, artificial hill surrounded by parks and porticos. It is one of only three monuments of Cleopatra's day that we can locate with accuracy today. The city's Jewish quarter stood in the northeast next to the palace. Greeks occupied the fine three-story houses at the center of town. Industry divided neighborhoods as well. One quarter was devoted to the manufacture of perfumes and to the fabrication of their alabaster pots, another to glass workers. From east to west, the city measured nearly 4 miles, a wonderland of baths, theaters, gymnasiums, courts, temples, shrines, and synagogues. A limestone wall surrounded its perimeter, punctuated by towers, patrolled at both ends of the Canopic Way by prostitutes. During the day, Alexandria echoed with the sounds of horses' hooves, the cries of porridge sellers or chickpea vendors, street performers, soothsayers, money lenders. Its spice stands released exotic aromas, carried through the streets by a thick, salty sea breeze. Long-legged white and black ibises assembled at every intersection, foraging for crumbs. Until well into the evening, when the vermilion sun plunged precipitously into the harbor, Alexandria remained a swirl of reds and yellows, a swelling kaleidoscope of music, chaos, and color. Altogether, it was a mood-altering city of extreme sensuality and high intellectualism, the Paris of the ancient world. Superior in its ways, splendid in its luxuries, the place to go to spend your fortune, write your poetry, find or forget a romance, restore your health, reinvent yourself, or regroup after having conquered vast swaths of Italy, Spain, and Greece over the course of a Herculean decade. Given the transporting beauty and rapturous entertainments, Alexandria was not a city into which one sank passively. As a visitor noted, it is not easy for a stranger to endure the clamor of so great a multitude, or to face these tens of thousands, unless he comes provided with a lute and a song. Alexandrians embraced their reputation for frivolity, and through the massive portal of the palace, hordes of well-wishers and Roman associates thronged at the war's conclusion, gathering in the ivory-paneled entrance hall. With its array of banqueting rooms, that complex could accommodate a vast crowd. Its largest hall was furnished with a dazzling collection of couches, sculpted of bronze, inlaid with ivory and glass, works of art unto themselves. Egypt imported its silver, but long controlled the greatest gold reserve of the ancient world. The beams of that hall may have been themselves overlaid with gold. It is easy to inflate the city's population, difficult to overstate its magnificence. It taxed the vocabularies even of the ancients. Plenty of wealthy Alexandrian households boasted furniture of Lebanon cedar inlaid with ivory and mother-of-pearl, sophisticated trompe-l'oeil, and intricate, realistic mosaics. Slabs of caramel-colored alabaster-sheathed exteriors. Interior walls shimmered with enamels and emeralds. Where wall decoration yielded to murals, mythological scenes predominated. The quality of the work was an astonishment. The floor mosaics were, in particular, worked with a remarkable precision, heavy on geometrics, often three-dimensional in feel, implausibly realistic in their depictions of the natural world. At banquets, those intricacies vanished under lush carpets of lilies and roses, with which Egypt was abundantly supplied. "The general rule," gushed one chronicler, "is that no flower, including roses, snowdrops, or anything else, ever completely stops blooming." Strewn in heaps over the floors, they lent the impression of a country meadow, if one littered, at meal's end, by oyster shells, lobster claws, and peach pits. There was nothing rare about a banquet order for 300 crowns of roses, or for as many braided garlands. Roses were crucial, their fragrance believed to prevent intoxication. Perfumes and unguents were Alexandrian's specialties. Attendants sprinkled cinnamon and cardamom and balsam perfumes on banqueters' crowns as musicians played or storytellers performed. Fragrance rippled not only from the table, but from jewelry, perfumed lamps, soles of shoes. The heavy scents of the oils inevitably flavored the dinner. The wares of the city's other preeminent artisans were on display as well. Tables glinted with silver basins, pitchers, hundreds of candelabra. Blown glass was a Hellenistic invention on which Alexandria had worked its usual magic, gilding the already elaborate lily. The city's glassblowers threaded gold into their work. On the table, polychromatic vessels joined silver platters, woven ivory bread baskets, jewel-encrusted tumblers. The meal itself appeared on gold dishes. At one Ptolemaic feast, the dinner vessels alone were said to have weighed 300 tons. That tableware showcased both Cleopatra's adaptability and her competitive instinct. When Alexandrian luxury began to make itself felt in the Roman world, Cleopatra renamed her ostentatious tableware. Her elaborate gold and silver place settings became her ordinary wear. To one guest, a palace dinner itself appeared as a fortune rather than a meal. He gaped at a silver platter covered with heavy gold plate and large enough to hold a huge roast piglet lying on its back and displaying its belly, which was full of many delicious items, for inside it were roast thrushes, ducks, and an immense quantity of warblers, as well as egg yolks, oysters, and scallops. Geese were standard fare on the prodigal menus, along with peacocks, oysters, sea urchins, sturgeon, and red mullet, the delicacies of the Mediterranean world. Spoons were rare, forks unknown. One ate with one's fingers. Sweet wines, the best came from Syria and Ionia, were spiced with honey or pomegranate. We have no trace of the wardrobe in which Cleopatra presided over these festivities, though we know that she wore plenty of pearls, the diamonds of the day. She coiled long ropes of pearls around her neck and braided more into her hair. She wore others sewn into the fabric of her tunics. Those were ankle length and lavishly colored, of fine Chinese silk or gauzy linen, traditionally worn belted, or with a brooch or ribbon. Over the tunic went an often transparent mantle, through which the bright folds of fabric were clearly visible. On her feet, Cleopatra wore jeweled sandals with patterned soles. Among the greatest hosts in history, the Ptolemies sent their guests stumbling home with gifts. It was not unusual to make off with a place setting of solid silver, a slave, a gazelle, a gold sofa, a horse in silver armor. Excess had put the Ptolemies on the map, where Cleopatra fully intended the dynasty to remain. Such were the prolonged parties until dawn, of which Suetonius would write later. The post-war festivities would certainly have included a victory procession, presumably down the Canopic Way. Cleopatra needed to unite her people, to assert her political supremacy, and to cement her claim over her detractors. Alexandria had long been a city of parades and pageantry, displays in which the wealth of the Ptolemies surpassed even the recreational fervor of their subjects. Centuries earlier, a Dionysian procession had introduced gilded 20-foot floats to the city streets, each requiring 180 men to coax it along. Purple-painted satyrs and gold-garlanded nymphs followed, along with allegorical representations of kings, gods, cities, seasons. A center of mechanical marvels, Alexandria boasted automatic doors and hydraulic lifts, hidden treadmills and coin-operated machines. With invisible wires, siphons, pulleys, and magnets, the Ptolemies could work miracles. Fires erupted and died down. Lights flickered from statues' eyes. Trumpets blared spontaneously. For the early procession, the city's ingenious metalworkers outdid themselves. A 15-foot-tall statue in a yellow-spangled tunic floated through the streets. She rose to her full height, poured offerings of milk, then magically reseated herself, enthralling the crowds. Around her, the air was thick with the buzz of anticipation, the murmurs of admiration, the music of flutes. Clouds of incense, essentially moneyed air, settled on the spectators, for whom the burnished wonders continued. Golden torch carriers, chests of frankincense and myrrh, gilded palm leaves, grapevines, breastplates, shields, statues, basins, gold-adorned oxen. Atop one cart, 60 satyrs trampled grapes, singing as they did so, accompanied by pipers. Vast skins disgorged scented wine into the streets. The air was sweetened first by incense, again by those fragrant streams, a heady combination. Attendants released doves and pigeons over the course of the procession, each with ribbons dangling from its feet. A display of animals was obligatory for the subjects who had traveled to Alexandria and pitched tents for miles around. The third century procession had included troops of decorated donkeys, elephants shod with gold-embroidered slippers, teams of oryxes, leopards, peacocks, enormous lions, an Ethiopian rhinoceros, ostriches, an albino bear, 2,400 dogs. Camels carried loads of saffron and cinnamon. Behind them paraded 200 bulls with gilded horns. Lyre players followed, along with 57,000 infantry and 23,000 cavalry in full armor. Cleopatra would not have had those battalions, but would all the same have mustered an extravagant display. The point was to advertise oneself among monarchs as the shrewdest amasser of wealth, the most splendid spendthrift, and the most magnificent in all works. Affluence, power, and legitimacy were inextricably bound together. Especially after the convulsions of the previous decades, it was essential that she confirm her authority. Caesar may well have stayed to that end. A stable Egypt was as critical to his plans as to Cleopatra's. Nearly alone in the Mediterranean, Egypt produced more grain than it consumed. Cleopatra could single-handedly feed Rome. The reverse was also true. She could starve that city if she cared to. For that reason, Caesar was disinclined to install a countryman in Alexandria. A reliable non-Roman was the best solution. It is clear that Caesar trusted Cleopatra as he could not have trusted Plotinus. Equally clear that he had confidence in her ability to rule. Strictly speaking, her Egypt became, as of 47, a protectorate with an intimate twist. That arrangement was by no means unorthodox in a century when politics were markedly personal. Hellenistic alliances were regularly ratified with wedding vows. In Rome, mercenary marriages were the order of the day, to the dismay of the purists who rallied at that brand of cheap, expedient diplomacy. The more ambitious the politician, the more variegated the marriages. Pompey had wed 5 times, always for political reasons. Caesar's tumultuous career was closely tied to each of his 4 wives. Despite an age difference comparable to that between Caesar and Cleopatra, Pompey had married Caesar's daughter, sent to him as a sort of thank you note. Footnote: the gift was welcome, but the timing was awkward. Julia had been set to marry Quintus Servilius Caepio in a matter of days. He was most displeased. In her place, Pompey offered Caepio his own daughter, although she, in turn, was already engaged to someone else. For the most part, Roman women were for horse trading, an idea that, for all their creative family machinations, rarely occurred to the Ptolemies. End of footnote. Relations between the two men soured only when the woman who bound them died, a history that would shortly repeat itself, with far greater repercussions. Caesar and Cleopatra's relationship was unusual not only for its national differences, but because Cleopatra entered into it of her own will. No male relative forced her hand. To a Roman, that was highly discomfiting. Had her father in his lifetime married her to Caesar, an impossibility on any number of counts, she would have been seen altogether differently. What unsettled those who wrote her history was her independence of mind, the enterprising spirit. The poet Lucan is clear on this point. Cleopatra had been able to capture the old man with magic, he has Plotinus exclaim, in a broad redefinition of free will. Already in possession is Egypt, she in his account, subsequently, whores to gain Rome. Here, too, there were instructive parallels. The story would later be told of an early Indian monarch, Queen Cleophas. She surrendered to Alexander, but subsequently regained her throne, which she ransomed by sleeping with him, attaining by sexual favors what she could not by force of arms. According to a Roman historian, at least, for her degrading behavior, Cleophas earned the epithet royal whore. The story may well be apocryphal, another lurid Roman fantasy about the beguiling East. It may even have been Cleopatra inflected. But it tells us something of Cleopatra. She was as suspect as Queen Cleophas, though what the Romans mostly seized upon, what inspired backhanded tributes, was her uncanny occult power. That an easy rapport, if not a great passion, developed between Cleopatra and Caesar was unsurprising. Her aplomb and his gamble may have clinched the deal, but their personalities were as neatly matched as their political agendas. They were congenial, charismatic, quick-tongued people, if only one of them would go down in history as having been so seductive as to be dangerous. Cleopatra especially knew how to ingratiate. Where there had been thought to be four kinds of flattery, Plutarch sputtered, always on guard against that noxious brew, she had 1,000. We have more tributes to the caress of her wit than to Caesar's. His is to be read less in his language than in his innumerable affairs. He was a masterly seducer, with a specialty in aristocratic wives. Both Cleopatra and Caesar manifested the intellectual curiosity that was the trademark of their age, a lightheartedness and a humor that set them apart from their peers, insofar as either had peers. Such an unsociable, solitary thing is power, notes Plutarch. Generally, those around Caesar and Cleopatra could be relied upon to fawn or plot. Both knew, as Caesar put it, that success came at a price, that everything that lifts people above their fellows arouses both emulation and jealousy. Theirs was an exclusive brand of social isolation. Both had daringly crossed lines in their bids for power. Both had let the dice fly. Both had as great a capacity for work as for play, and rarely distinguished between the two. Caesar answered letters and petitions while attending games. Cleopatra engaged in games for reasons of state. Neither shrank from drama. Both were natural performers, as secure in their ability as in the conviction of their superiority. Much was expected of Cleopatra, who liked to surprise, believed in the grand geste, and did not sell herself short. Caesar put a premium on style and admired talent in all its forms. In Alexandria, he was in the constant company of a deft conversationalist, linguist, and negotiator, one who shared his unusual gift for treating new acquaintances as if they were old intimates. There was ample reason on his part for close attention. Cleopatra provided a timely lesson in comportment. Having the year before been declared dictator, Caesar was enjoying his first taste of absolute power. Cleopatra, moreover, handled matters no woman of his acquaintance had touched. He would have been hard-pressed to find a woman in all of Rome who had raised an army, lent a fleet, controlled a currency. As incandescent as was her personality, Cleopatra was every bit Caesar's equal as a cool-headed, clear-eyed pragmatist, though what passed on his part as strategy would be remembered on hers as manipulation. Both were emerging from wars that had nothing to do with issues and everything to do with personalities. They had faced similar difficulties with similar constituencies. Caesar was no favorite of the Roman aristocracy. Cleopatra was unloved by the Alexandrian Greeks. Their power derived from the common people. The ambitious shine especially in the company of the ambitious. Caesar and Cleopatra came together as might two heirs to legendary fortunes, larger than life and abundantly aware of their gifts, who are accustomed to thinking of themselves in the plural or writing of themselves in the third person. In the course of one of Cleopatra's banquets, Lucan imagines Caesar quizzing Egypt's high priest. Caesar is a student of a great many subjects, a man of boundless curiosity. His love of exploration was as pronounced as his ambition. He was fascinated by Egyptian lore and culture. In Alexandria, he conferred with scientists and philosophers. He has but one request. "There is nothing I would rather know," he pleads, "than the causes of the river, which lie hidden through so many ages and its unknown source. If the priest will reveal the source of the Nile, Caesar will abandon warfare." The fervor was understandable. Few mysteries of the ancient world were as compelling. The source of the Nile was the life on Mars of its day. Lucan is the first to mention Caesar and Cleopatra's cruise on the river, 110 years after the fact. He admired neither party and was writing verse. He has been called the father of yellow journalism for good reason. All the same, he was working from historical sources lost to us today. He is unlikely to have invented the trip. Nor was there any reason to believe the post-war cruise any less luxurious or frantic with entertainments than the one Shakespeare would ultimately immortalize, still 5 years in the future. There is better reason to assume Roman historians preferred to remember that journey and forget this one. They made no mention either of Caesar having tarried in Egypt at the war's conclusion. Footnote. One modern historian goes so far as to suggest they expressly covered it up. End of footnote. Had they not closed ranks as they did, Shakespeare might well have written Cleopatra into a different play. There was ample precedent for a Nile trip. It was traditional to welcome a foreign dignitary with a cruise to introduce him to the marvel that was Egypt. 2 generations earlier, a high official went to great lengths to ensure that a Roman senator traveling in Egypt be received with the utmost magnificence, showered with gifts, entrusted to expert guides, supplied with the pastries and roasted meats with which to feed the sacred crocodiles. Egypt's miles upon miles of grain fields inevitably impressed, even as they made Roman fingers twitch. And burning curiosity aside, there were legitimate state reasons for the excursion. A new ruler traditionally inaugurated his or her reign with a ceremonial journey south. For Cleopatra, this amounted to a proprietary tour of her personal estate. Everyone in Egypt worked for her. Nearly every resource of the country, its fields, its game, its trees, the Nile and its crocodiles themselves, was hers. From her point of view, the cruise was not so much a pleasure trip or a scientific expedition as a state obligation. With it, she provided a critical display of Roman military might to her people, a display of Egyptian abundance to Rome. The people of Egypt had supplied her against her brother when she was vulnerable. With Caesar at her side, she returned to them patently invincible. To journey from Alexandria south was to leave the Greek-speaking for the Egyptian-speaking world, to travel from wine country to beer country. Here was the culture to which Alexandrians felt themselves superior, where pharaohs were revered and priests held sway. Here Cleopatra's divinity went unquestioned. Even without the Alexandrian pageantry, the agate and the red granite, the monumental past monumentally displayed, the landscape was a wonder. As a later traveler along the same stretch put it, I gulped down color, like a donkey gorging on oats. Cleopatra introduced Caesar to the world's longest and most spectacular oasis, to the velvety green of the riverbanks, to the hard black soil of the channel, to the land of red-purple sunsets and amethyst dawns. The two could not have neglected the obligatory stops. The pyramids, which soared above the palms to melt into the haze, the sanctuary and temples of Memphis, where Egypt's high priest would have been on hand to receive them, the 3,000 chambers above and below ground of the granite and limestone labyrinth, the lakeside shrine of the crocodile gods, where the beasts had been trained to open their jaws on command, and where Caesar may have been as taken by the system of locks and dams which had reclaimed farmland, the colossi of Memnon, miraculously white against the pale apricot sand, 68 feet tall and visible from miles around. Up the hill behind them, deep in the rock, lay the tombs of the Valley of the Kings. Farther south came the handsome Temple of Isis, decorated and partly built by Cleopatra's father, set on an island among the tossing rapids at Philae. Footnote. The Sphinx was almost certainly invisible to Caesar and Cleopatra, buried still in sand, as it had been for nearly 1,000 years. End of footnote. More miraculous yet were the accommodations, to which the taste for the colossal extended as well. The idea was to impress as much as to entertain. Cleopatra and Caesar would have left from Lake Mareotis, south of the city, where her pleasure fleet docked. That port could accommodate 300-foot-long royal barges. Their bows were ivory, elaborate colonnades lined the deck, the column shafts of minutely carved cypress. 18-foot gilded statues decorated stern and prow. The ship's hardware was polished bronze, its woodwork embedded with ivory and gold. All was brilliantly painted, including the shipboard collection of royal statuary, which decorated the two floors of living and entertaining quarters. A coffered ceiling covered one banqueting room. Egyptian-style columns decorated another, carved with acanthus leaves and lotus petals, in an alternating black and white pattern. Over a third stretched a purple awning, held aloft by arched beams. It was not unusual for a royal barge to include a gym, a library, shrines to Dionysus and Aphrodite, a garden, a grotto, lecture halls, a spiral staircase, a copper bath, stables, an aquarium. Theirs was no modest procession. A mid-level bureaucrat traveled with an entourage of 10, lost as he was without his secretaries and accountants, his baker, his bath attendants, his doctor, his silver steward, his arms master. Cleopatra and Caesar headed south among a swarm of Roman soldiers and Egyptian courtiers. Hospitality during their stay was incumbent on the people, and a daunting assignment, especially if, as Appian asserts, a fleet of 400 ships followed behind. Certainly a multitude of smaller vessels followed their queens, along a river thick with stone and wine carriers, merchant galleys, police skiffs. It was the people's responsibility to feed and cosset their monarch, to shower gifts upon her, to entertain her retinue, to arrange transportation. This raised all sorts of lodging, security, and provisioning concerns. Officials were not above advising subordinates to hide supplies in order to prevent royal requisitioning. That was perfectly reasonable, given the demands. One insignificant official called for 372 suckling pigs and 200 sheep. Farmers worked day and night to produce the necessary stores, to ferment beer, stockpile hay, furnish guest houses, round up donkeys. They did so now in the thick of harvest season. With greater resources and under less complex circumstances, Cicero would be happy to bid Caesar goodbye when he entertained the general and his entourage 2 years later at his country estate. He was relieved not to have to ask Caesar to drop by again when next in the neighborhood. Once is enough, Cicero sighed, having felt less host than quartermaster. Up the Nile, Cleopatra and Caesar sailed in their floating palace, the wind at their backs. On shore, the date trees hung thick with fruit, the palm fronds slightly faded. Beyond the river lay a sea of golden grain. In the trees, the bananas glinted yellow. The apricots, grapes, figs, and mulberries were nearly ripe. It was peach season. Above their heads, the pigeons visibly paired off. Everything about the landscape before Caesar and Cleopatra reinforced the myths of Egypt's abundance and the river's magical faculties. Renowned throughout the ancient world, the Nile was said to flow with gold. Extraordinary powers were ascribed to it. Its water was believed to boil at half the temperature of other waters. Its river creatures attained staggering proportions. Ptolemy II had sent his daughter cases of Nile water when she married into the Syrian royal family to ensure her fertility. She was already 30. It worked. Egyptian women were known for more efficient pregnancies. It took them less time to produce a baby. They were said as well to have an elevated rate of giving birth to twins, often quadruplets. Goats, which bore two kids elsewhere, were said to bear 5 in Egypt, pigeons to produce 12 broods rather than 10. The male skull was thought to be stronger in Egypt, where baldness and comb-overs like Caesar's were rare. The Nile was believed to have spontaneously generated life. One thing Cleopatra and Caesar did not see were the river creatures of legend, half mice, half dirt. Nor, presumably, did they find serpents with grass sprouting on their backs, or people who lived under turtle shells the size of boats. What they did make out among the tufted papyrus thickets and the lotus plants were herons and storks, hippopotami and 18-foot-long crocodiles, an inexhaustible supply of fish, a rarity in Rome. The ancient historians were mistaken about the primordial details, wholly accurate on the subject of Egypt's fecundity. Cleopatra's home was the most productive agricultural land in the Mediterranean, the one in which crops appeared to plant and water themselves. That had been true since time immemorial, an expression that in Egypt actually meant something. Even in Cleopatra's day, there was such a thing as ancient history. Somehow the world was older then, thick with legend, swathed in superstition. At her side, Caesar could have marveled at 28 centuries of architecture. Already visitors had burgled and scrawled graffiti over the tombs in the Valley of the Kings. Footnote. The most common graffito, "I saw, and I was amazed." End of footnote. Already by the spring of 47, one of the 7 wonders of the world lay in ruins. Cleopatra's country had been in the hospitality business long before the rest of the world, so much as suspected gracious living existed. At the same time, the centuries felt closer than they do to us today. Alexander the Great was further from Cleopatra than 1776 is to our century. Yet Alexander remained always vividly, urgently present. While 1,120 years separated Cleopatra from the greatest story of her time, The fall of Troy remained a steadfast point of reference. The past was at all times within reach, a nearly religious awe aimed in its direction. This was especially true in Egypt, which had a passion for history, and which for two millennia already had kept a written record. For the bulk of those years, the insular, inaccessible country had changed little, its art barely at all. There was good reason why Cleopatra's subjects viewed time as a coil of endless repetitions. Recent events only reinforced that notion. Ptolemaic advisers had persuaded earlier boy kings to murder their immediate families. Previous queens had fled Egypt to muster armies. Much that could be said of the conquering Romans in 47 could have been said 3 centuries earlier of Cleopatra's Macedonian ancestors, a parallel by no means lost on her. In white linen and a diadem, Cleopatra took part throughout the trip in religious rituals that were themselves thousands of years old. She styled herself every bit the living divinity. We do not know how her people displayed their obeisance, but they likely bowed in her presence or raised a hand in some form of salute. To those who lined up for a view on shore and along the causeways, Caesar and Cleopatra represented not a romance, but a sort of magical apparition from another world, the earthly visitation of two living gods. They made for quite a sight. The fair-haired, broad-shouldered Roman, a study in hollows and sinews in his long purple mantle, with the dark, small-boned Queen of Egypt at his side. Together they visited sacred sites, the monuments of ancient kings, the secondary palaces along the river. Together they were greeted by white-robed priests and cheering crowds. Together they sailed among farmsteads, across a landscape dotted with mud-brick towers and red-terraced roofs, past luxuriant orchards and vineyards and golden fields, sphinxes half-buried in sand, cliffs of rock-cut tombs. Together they battled the gnats, a seasonal gift of the low river. From a distance they announced themselves with a clatter of oars and the strumming of lyres. In their wake, the bite of incense lingered in the sultry air. Certainly the trip was a vacation compared to the weeks that had preceded it. That it was a debauched pleasure cruise, a lark, a honeymoon, was probably an idea generated by the lavish accommodations. A Roman needed look no further for depravity. By definition, the Latin tongue encountered something rotten when it met the word luxury, which derives from the verb to dislocate, and which spent thousands of years conjoined with lascivious. According to Appian, Caesar journeyed up the Nile with Cleopatra and enjoyed himself with her in other ways as well. From there, it was no great leap to the charge that Cleopatra had borne the Roman general off on this folly, one of her design, into the exotic heart of an exotic country, from which he had forcibly to be torn. Cleopatra, or Egypt, tended to have this effect on poor, vulnerable Romans. Her country was itself a tease and a temptation. The itinerary was presumably planned in advance and adhered to, but would not be remembered that way. By later accounts, Caesar was reluctant to leave, Cleopatra reluctant to let him go. She would have detained him even longer in Egypt, or else would have set out with him at once for Rome, was Dio's take. Only against his will did Caesar's men coax him back. In Suetonius's version, Caesar had so lost his head over the Egyptian queen that he would have followed her to the Ethiopian frontier had his soldiers not threatened to mutiny. They got their way finally between the rugged cliffs south of modern-day Aswan, where the procession effected an unwieldy about-face. Dio has Caesar waking slowly to the realization that a delay in Egypt was neither creditable nor profitable to him, but omits any context for the lull on the river. Caesar had at the time no living children, nor in the course of three marriages had he fathered a son. On that count, Egypt upheld its legendary reputation. In swelling tribute to the fecundity of her land, the one in which flowers bloomed perpetually and wheat harvested itself, Cleopatra was that spring in her last months of pregnancy. She roundly confirmed the myth of the propagative powers of her magnificent country. The two spent somewhere between 3 and 9 weeks on the river and turned back at the first cataract of the Nile. The current carried them gently back to the palace. From Alexandria, Caesar set off for Armenia, then in a state of revolt. Late in June, Cleopatra gave birth to a half-Roman child, divine on two counts, once as a Ptolemy, again as a Caesar. Here, at last, was something new under the sun. Chapter 4. The Golden Age never was the present age. Servant, what excuses shall I make if I am away from the house for a long time? Andromache, you will find no shortage of pretexts. After all, you are a woman. Euripides. Caesar left Egypt on June 10th, far later than he should have. Rome had been without word from him since December and was in turmoil, as he surely knew. The mails worked perfectly well. In what was as much a personal as a political favor, he took Cleopatra's sister, still a sibling-loving god, in name if not demeanor, with him as a prisoner of war. To protect Cleopatra, 12,000 of the legionnaires who had followed Caesar remained in Egypt, again a gesture both personal and political. Civil unrest was in neither of their best interests. Caesar indeed appears to have been disinclined to leave Cleopatra, although it is implausible that she proposed accompanying him to Rome that summer, as Dio claims. There was almost certainly talk of a reunion before the departure, which Caesar seems to have delayed and delayed until he could do so no longer. 2 weeks later, Cleopatra went into labor. We know as little of the actual birth as we do of the intimacy that preceded it. Footnote. Like so much else in her life, the Nile cruise, the Roman stay, her good faith at Actium, the paternity of this child and the timing of his birth have been contested. His appearance seemed too good and too opportune to be true. Otherwise, the skeptic's case rests on Caesar's presumed infertility. Despite a vigorous sex life, he had sired no progeny in 36 years. As early as Suetonius, the paternity issue was raised. There is a curious silence in the record where one might expect outrage and, too, an absence of material evidence. That silence can be read equally as affirmation. The birth was so distasteful, the evidence that Cleopatra had hoodwinked Caesar so great, that it was wise to keep the matter quiet. Caesar certainly thought the child his, as did both Antony and Augustus. End of footnote. With or without a birthing stool, a team of midwives would have stood at the ready. One received the child in a bundle of cloth, securely swaddling him. A second cut the umbilical cord with an obsidian blade. The newborn was to be amply filled with milk, to which end a royal wet nurse was engaged. The requirements for the job were no different from those for a sitter today. The nurse should be congenial and clean. She should not be prone to anger, not talkative, nor indifferent in the taking of food, but organized and sensible. Ideally, she should also be Greek, which was to say, educated. Typically, she was the lucky wife of a court official. Hers was a well-remunerated, prestigious post, several years in duration. To it, she brought generations' worth of wisdom. Teething trouble? The standard cure was to feed the child a fried mouse. excessive crying, a paste of fly dirt and poppy could be counted on to silence the most miserable of infants. Had she wanted to, Cleopatra could have availed herself of volumes of advice on contraception and abortion, some of it surprisingly effective. Nothing better revealed the conflicting tides of science and myth, enlightenment and ignorance between which she lived, than the literature on birth control. For each valid idea of Cleopatra's age, there was an equally outlandish belief. Hippocrates' 300-year-old recipe for inducing miscarriage, jump up and down, neatly touching your heels to your buttocks 7 times, made some of the first century measures look perfectly reasonable. A spider's egg, attached to the body with deer hide before sunrise, could prevent conception for 12 months. This was no stranger, or more effective, than attaching a cat liver to one's left foot. But then it was also asserted that a sneeze during sex worked wonders. In Cleopatra's day, crocodile dung was famed for its contraceptive powers, as was a concoction of mule's kidney and eunuch's urine. Generally, the literature on abortifacients was more extensive than that on contraceptives. The time-tested ingredients for a morning-after pill were salt, mouse excrement, honey, and resin. Long after Cleopatra, it was asserted that the smell of a freshly extinguished lamp induced miscarriage. At the same time, some of the popular herbal remedies of Cleopatra's age proved effective. White poplar, juniper berries, and giant fennel have qualified contraceptive powers. Others, vinegar, alum, and olive oil, remained in use until recently. Early diaphragms existed of wool moistened with honey and oil. All offered better results than the rhythm method, of dubious benefit to a people who believed that a woman was at her most fertile around the time of menstruation. As it happened, nothing could better have suited the 22-year-old Cleopatra's political agenda than motherhood. And no single act could have secured her future better than bearing Julius Caesar's child. There were a few awkwardnesses, beginning with the fact that each of the new parents was married to someone else. Technically speaking, Cleopatra had been both widowed and remarried in the course of the pregnancy. From the Egyptian point of view, Caesar was an imperfect father on 2 counts. He was neither a Ptolemy nor royal. And from the Roman point of view, there was no advantage whatsoever in broadcasting his paternity, an embarrassment at best. From Cleopatra's perspective, no diplomatic measure could have been as effective as this entirely private one. She'd been too preoccupied with her own survival to have given much thought to succession. But she could now expect to be spared the fate of Alexander the Great, who died without an heir. The splendid Ptolemaic dynasty would survive her. Moreover, the child was a boy. The Egyptians were willing to submit to a female pharaoh, but as Berenice IV's messy marital history made clear, a woman needed a male consort, if only as a ballerina does in a Balanchine pas de deux, as ornament rather than support. With Caesarion, or Little Caesar, as the Alexandrians nicknamed Ptolemy XV Caesar, on her lap, Cleopatra had no difficulty ruling as a female king. Even before he began to babble, Caesarion accomplished a masterly feat. He rendered his feckless uncle wholly irrelevant. Whether Ptolemy XIV realized it or not, his older sister had gained control both of the imagery and the government. Best of all, Cleopatra's timing was impeccable. She indeed seems to have had help, or great good luck, in producing children precisely when it was most advantageous to do so. Caesarion's birth coincided almost exactly with the early summer rise of the Nile, which psychologically, iconographically, and financially ushered in the season of plenty. Daily anticipation gave way to celebration as the Nile grew turbid and mossy green, then swelled steadily from south to north. Basket after basket filled with grapes, figs, and melons. The honey flowed abundantly. Cleopatra celebrated the annual Feast of Isis at this time, an important ritual-heavy date on the Egyptian calendar. The tears of that all-powerful goddess were said to account for the rise of the river. Cleopatra's subjects offered her compulsory gifts on the holiday, a practice that set off a frenzied competition among her courtiers. Boats arrived at the palace from every corner of Egypt, loaded with fruits and flowers. Caesarion's birth drove home Cleopatra's association with Isis, but on that count, Cleopatra took her cue from her most illustrious ancestors, who for 250 years had identified with that ancient goddess. In the age of general longing, she ranked as the greatest deity of the day. She enjoyed nearly unlimited powers. Isis had invented the alphabet, both Egyptian and Greek, separated earth from sky, set the sun and the moon on their way. Fiercely, but compassionately, she plucked order from chaos. She was tender and comforting, also the mistress of war, thunderbolts, the sea. She cured the sick and raised the dead. She presided over love affairs, invented marriage, regulated pregnancies, inspired the love that binds children to parents, smiled on domestic life. She dispensed mercy, salvation, redemption. She is the consummate earth mother, also, like most mothers, something of a canny, omnicompetent, behind-the-scenes magician. Isis appealed equally to both of Cleopatra's constituencies, offering, as she did, a versatile conflation of two cultures. In a land where many answered to different names in Greek and Egyptian, the goddess served as nation-builder and religious icon. Demeter, Athena, Hera, and Aphrodite combined in her person. Her temples dotted Alexandria. Her terracotta statuette graced most homes. A commanding woman with a distinctly sensual aura, she was a less comfortable presence abroad. Already that powerful enchantress had flustered the more martial Roman world to which Alexandrian traders had exported her cult. Caesar had himself barred Isis priests from entering Rome. As early as 80 BC, an Isis temple had stood in that city, on the Capitoline Hill. It was destroyed and rebuilt, a history that repeated itself at regular intervals over the course of Cleopatra's lifetime. Such was the popularity of Isis that when the order to dismantle her temples was issued in 50, no workman would pick up an axe to do so. A consul was obliged to strip off his toga and minister the first blows himself. It is difficult to determine which came first, whether Isis accounted for the supremacy of women in Egypt, or whether the Ptolemaic queens reinforced her eminence. Footnote. Sounding some familiar inaccurate notes, a historian of Cleopatra's day credited Isis with Egypt's upside-down social hierarchy. In deference to her great wisdoms, claimed Diodorus, the Egyptians had ordained that the queen should have greater power and honor than the king, and that among private persons, the wife should enjoy authority over her husband, the husbands agreeing in the marriage contract that they will be obedient in all things to their wives. End of footnote. Certainly she introduced an equality of the sexes. In some accounts, Isis grants women the same strength as men. She was, in any event, a perfect boon to Cleopatra. To celebrate Caesarion's birth, the new mother ordered coins struck on which he is depicted as Horus, Isis's infant son. The imagery was conveniently bilingual. It read just as easily as Aphrodite with Eros. Future events would only reinforce Cleopatra's identification with Isis, into whose role she would step more fully and literally than had any previous Ptolemy. On ceremonial occasions, she assumed her guise, appearing in a full, finely pleated linen mantle of iridescent stripes, fringed at the bottom, tightly wrapped from right hip to left shoulder, and knotted between the breasts. Under it, she wore a snug Greek sheath or chiton. Corkscrew curls fell around her neck. On her head, she wore a diadem, or, on religious occasions, a traditional pharaonic crown of feathers, solar disk, and cow's horns. 47 years later, the Protean Isis would cede her place to a very different single mother, who appropriated her imagery wholesale. Motherhood not only enhanced Cleopatra's authority. In her day, the Egyptian queen was more earth mother than femme fatale, but solidified her links with the native priests, to whom she granted significant privileges. In this, she continued the work of her father. Even while abroad, he had distinguished himself as a prolific builder of temples and had cultivated his relations with the Egyptian clergy. They were central to order amid the native populace, also intimately engaged with matters of state. As the temples stood at the center of both religious and commercial life, there was an interpenetration of the Greek bureaucracy and the Egyptian hierarchy. The minister of finance might equally supervise the feeding of the sacred animals. The priest in charge of cult revenues for special occasions might double as a reed merchant. Those with weighty titles at the Temple of Memphis held equally weighty titles in the world of commerce and occupied privileged positions at Cleopatra's court. The relationship was symbiotic. A god on earth, a pharaoh was as necessary to the priests theologically as were the priests to Cleopatra economically and politically. Priests functioned as lawyers and notaries, the temples as manufacturing centers, cultural institutions, economic hubs. You might visit one to work up a contract, or consult a doctor, or borrow a sack of grain. A temple could grant refuge within its walls, a right Cleopatra extended in 46 to an Isis shrine, toward the end of her reign, to a synagogue in the southern delta. It may have represented her half of a bargain. The Jews of the region were fine soldiers. Cleopatra needed an army at the time. In principle, no one granted asylum could be driven or dragged away. It was where you withdrew when you had had the temerity to organize a strike. The temples lent money, even on occasion, to Ptolemies. It was as well the priest's responsibility to monitor every mood of the Nile, with which Egypt's fortunes literally rose and fell. The river could deliver bountiful riches or considerable disaster. A flood of 24 feet induced delirium. 21 feet brought good cheer. 18 feet, a season in which the blue-gray sludge clung to the riverbanks and sullenly refused to extend itself over the land, signaled a season of trouble. Such had been the case the previous year, when the Nile appeared to have been as out of joint as the times. As Cleopatra had observed on her clandestine trip to Alexandria, the flood of 48 was disastrous. In the end, it measured only 7.5 feet, the lowest rise on record. With the drought, the Egyptian economy had ground to a halt. Another reason anti-Roman recruits had been easy to come by that fall. The river dictated intimate family relations as much as it did national policy. One son signed an agreement with his mother. He was to supply her with specific quantities of wheat, oil, and salt, unless the river fell beneath a certain level, at which point she was to do his housekeeping. Many temples had Nilotic measuring columns, monitored secretly and obsessively by their priests. Daily they compared those figures to the previous years. From them, Cleopatra's officials could assess harvests and calculate taxes. Given the mania for measures and comparative data, it makes sense that geometry came of age in Egypt. The fixation on past performances accounted for the embrace of history as well, although that discipline was less exact. Feeding the people was paramount, a mandate on which Cleopatra prided herself. She depicted herself as the Lady of Abundance for good reason. She stood between her subjects and hunger. Given the rigors of the system, they could manage no reserves. In a crisis, Cleopatra had no choice but to authorize distributions from crown warehouses. "There was no famine during my reign," was a popular and gratifying phrase for a monarch to inscribe on his or her temples. Ancient propaganda served the same ends as its modern counterpart, however. There appears to have been little correlation between the elementary reality and that sunny assertion, as often as not, patently false. By the middle of 47, Cleopatra was free of conspiring court officials and relieved of all antagonistic family members. Civil disturbance was at a minimum. She had her hands full all the same. Anyone familiar with the wearying work required of kings by all those letters they must read or write would not bother even to pick up a diadem from the ground.